Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network. In case you don't know, my go-to karaoke song. I forgot to do Shithole Weather today. Happy Friday from Churchbridge in Saskatchewan, don't you know? Thanks, Mac, for making time for listeners while expeditionary last week. It was good to hear the joy in your voice as you shared your Montana experiences. Clear skies and southwest winds at 7 miles an hour today. The 95% humidity from thunderstorms that rolled through overnight makes the current temperature of 73 feel like 84. The high of 88 this afternoon is forecasted to feel like 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Central air conditioning will thankfully keep me comfortable. And then there's a cartoon that says, "You're a fly fisherman? Have you ever tried catching fish?" Now, I didn't do any fly fishing last week, but I watched a bunch of it. And, I mean, for me, it seems like the kind of fishing that, if I were to take up fishing, that I would like to do, because it's a fairly active event, right? It's not the sedentary North Dakota event where you wet a line and sit in the boat and get devoured by mosquitoes, which doesn't look at all appealing to me, okay? So, anyway, but I will say this, the fly fisher dudes, they weren't catching that much fish. Yeah, I don't want to judge them or anything like that, but not the easiest thing in the world. Now, they were telling me why. They were explaining that to me, you know, why. "We'll tell you why, Mac." I said, "Okay, I'm all ears, man. Tell me." And so they said, "Look, in this part of the river's shallow. And so because of its shallowness, it moves relatively quickly. Now, if we're in a part of the river that was deeper with deeper pools, the fish would kind of stay longer and we might have more luck." I said, "That sounds like bold talk from One-Eyed Fat Man, their rooster Cogburn." And they didn't take that very well. So anyway, now I want you to listen to John Allen here, okay? And I was listening to this yesterday. I thought, oh man, that's great stuff. So, all right, let me get to the right parts.
On the All Warrior Radio Network.
It's from 2016. Little Johnny Mellencamp bumper music. The song's called "Check It Out." The question is, what am I doing, right? Because I'm not hopping on the air right away. So, what am I doing? What am I messing with?
"Million young boys screaming out their words. The world full of people living to be good."
Because there's a reason that the bumper music plays along. And that's normally, I'm not in the room, right? Or I'm writing something down, or I'm looking for something. So it's not it's never artistic, okay? This is a little peek behind the curtain. Yeah, there's been about a half dozen entry points where you would naturally ease into the program so far. I could be talking to General Allen. Right. Telling him what we're going to do. Yeah, that's the ticket.
Johnny Mellencamp here on a Friday. I want to play "What Do You Do?" Right? "What Do You Do?" I want to play John Allen for you before Mike Musselman comes on. So, John Allen here about the Middle East.
You're listening to All Marine Radio.
So this is like me playing me How crazy is that? So this is excerpts from an interview that we did after the Nice event. All right.
Previously recorded.
Oh.
What do we do?
About where we are relative to winning the peace. Is it going to be a longer term event than we would like it to be? But simply that's the nature of the beast when we're trying to engineer such a fundamental change in that part of the world.
Okay, now that's a question involving Afghanistan, okay? And to a certain extent into Iraq. But Iraq was a nation, right? Afghanistan wasn't. I mean, it had a national border and everything. But, you know, Iraq, you know, a relatively modern nation in the Middle East. Afghanistan, not so much.
It's going to take longer, Mac, than the timeline that this White House has put on it, frankly. And I've been public on this issue. I think that the numbers that we have dedicated to the process are too few, and the timeline for our withdrawal is too short. And I've called on the administration, and I've called on others to reexamine both of those. And this is not the last you'll hear of me on this subject. You know, we went from a Japan that was flat on its back at the end of World War II to today having the third strongest economy on the planet. We went from a Korea that was flat on its back at the end of the Korean War to having the ninth or tenth most effective economy on the planet, a very effective democracy, as is Japan's democracy. The same with Germany. You know, Germany is an economic and political powerhouse. And none of those things occurred because we did, in the aftermath of war, 5 years of a limited presence and then pulled out. I almost can't imagine where we would be today if that had been the driving operational thinking at the time. You know, I commanded roughly 150,000 troops, spending between $8 and $9 billion a month. And for us to go from that size force to something less than 10,000 and do it for only 5 years and expect that with an active insurgency that has no intention of coming to the table, and Pakistan, which appears to have no intention of being helpful in the peace process, nor to reduce its safe havens, which have given sanctuary to the Taliban now for years, with virtually none of those things really changed, except that we certainly pushed the Taliban back as we were building the Afghan security forces out. Our departure, just as it did in Iraq, is going to create a risk, a level of risk, and we have to recognize that. So my concerns are that our numbers are too few and our drawdown timeline is too quick, but there's no bad time to make the right decision, and my hope would be that we can get this under control relatively soon, and the new administration, I don't want to get into the politics, but the new administration will take the time to do a comprehensive assessment of the relationship, the inextricable relationship of the political health of the nation with its economic progress, with the security situation, because they're all inextricably linked. They're all tied together, to take the time to do the kind of assessment necessary to determine, in the aftermath of several years of post-conflict international support, whether we're on track or not. Because if we just maintain this drawdown schedule and numbers, I think we're creating for ourselves the same kind of challenge that we now have to address a second time in Iraq. We have, for all intents and purposes, have been successful in the conflict. But these conflicts don't end when the guns fall silent, so to speak. These conflicts end many years or even sometimes decades later. And it requires a constant touch of some form or another. But you can't just say, and you just can't isolate the security dimension of what you're doing from the economic dimension of what you're doing and from the governance as well. You simply can't isolate them. They're all inextricably linked. So when you pull down our security presence, it also then forces the embassy to pull back its capability of touching key Afghan leaders who, now feeling exposed, because there's the security presence and the security calculus has changed, and feeling neglected because there's no American political touch, it creates a sense, as you pointed out correctly, that there will be a willingness to accommodate the enemy. And when that occurs, since the enemy has never been about economic progress or any kind of economic situation that we would recognize, then the economy begins to flag and money starts to flee. So they're all inextricably linked. And my position would be, please stop the drawdown right now. That doesn't mean we haven't been successful. That doesn't mean we failed. That doesn't mean that the intent to draw down was bad. But let's stop for now, because the Taliban are not willing to make peace. We just killed Mullah Mansour, who needed killing, because we thought he might be a partner for peace. It turned out to be even worse. So he needed to go away. We now have the emergence of something called the Wilayat Khorasan, which is a province of the ISIL caliphate, which has emerged in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and it is a further complication to the security situation. It's time for us to stop the drawdown and take a moment and a deep breath, because the next president is going to end up owning the outcome in Afghanistan. Let's let her or him take the time, having stopped the drawdown, having frozen everything in place, let's let her or him do a detailed assessment of the state of the governance, the state of the economy, in the context of the state of the security, because they're all inextricably linked. And if we don't take a big step backwards and a strong, thorough investigation of this, we're liable to find ourselves once again re-employing troops back into Afghanistan, and now, just as we are in Iraq, in an emergency situation.
Now, this is John Allen from an interview that I did with him in 2016. And to me, what's really interesting is you'll see him link, right, the politics to the military, right, to the adversary, to history, right? And so I was listening to this yesterday, and I thought, you know, I should – there's such good stuff. I mean, when these guys talk about the issues – I mean, John Allen, you know, he runs Brookings now, but, you know, he'd run Afghanistan. And so when you look at world events, you get some idea of the complexity of it. And then you look at, in my opinion, you look at the folly of trying to do this stuff in the short term. What did you expect? And then you look to the Pentagon, you look to the State Department, you look to the administration, and the administration he's talking about here is the Obama administration, okay? Because the election will take place in November of 2016, and that is the Clinton-Trump election. So that's when he talked about the administration, and that is stop the drawdown. And again, 4 years later, what are we doing? Coinciding with another election, you know, we're doing another drawdown. Okay, and so again, and then he contrasts that with, you know, post-World War II American policy, where we stayed in Germany and Japan for, you know, 60 years. So again, his words, as I listened to him yesterday, were thought-provoking, right? And so I thought I'd dust him off again here this morning. So and we continued this interview, and here he is again.
You asked about ISIL first. Let me take a huge...
All right, this is, if you're just joining us, this is John Allen talking about the long-term fix in the Middle East. Now, I know there's people that I've spoken to that say they don't agree with him. He's a pretty smart guy. And what you're seeing is the president, he had a press conference last week and said he was going to raise the cap level on what he was leaving in Afghanistan.
Now, he's talking about President Obama. I'm talking about Allen's remarks, and he's referring to when we talk about the president at the time, it's President Obama who was walking back the numbers that he said he would leave in Afghanistan.
To 8,500. And earlier this week, there was the announcement by the Pentagon that more troops were going to Iraq. 500 more. And then there was an announcement yesterday, I believe, that there would be additional troops sent to adjacent nations so they would be in the region, okay, which is a step from getting them in the country. So anyway, this is General Allen talking about. So it looks like, for all intents and purposes, the president is doing what he's saying. We're ramping back up in Iraq, right? And we'll keep an eye on that to see if what we're doing is prudent or not. And we've slowed the rate of descent in terms of our troop levels down in Afghanistan. And you could link it to attempting not to create a situation similar to the one, as General Allen points out, that we created for ourselves in Iraq.
Step back and tell you that unless we, as a community of nations in the West, are willing to approach the issue of the radicalization of hundreds of thousands of young...
Okay, now, I want you to listen to this, because this is a pretty important thing that he says about the West and this problem that we see continuing to manifest itself. Now, I don't know if the thing in Nice wasn't just a mentally jacked up dude. Okay? But look,
the thing in Nice is the truck driver driving down the promenade, killing, I want to say, almost 60 people and injuring like 500. So that's the event in Nice that I refer to.
Talk about the larger Middle East problem that the Western nations have. And this is him going to address it.
Are willing to approach the issue of the radicalization of hundreds of thousands of young Muslims around the world. And this is not about being a Muslim. It's about conditions that lead to mass hopelessness and the radicalization in the sense of fury that their parent governments have no capacity to care for them, no intention to care for them, and no potential to care for them, unless we as a community of nations are willing to undertake an endeavor as big as the Marshall Plan, a generational approach, we are going to be facing an issue of mass radicalization and extremist organizations, violent extremist organizations like ISIL, for generations. And we have to grip this, because the solution, Mac, cannot be frozen conflict. The solution cannot be permanent war. And your sons are already young officers in the Marine Corps. I've got a grandson who likely will serve in the Corps. And I don't want to see your sons fight extremist organizations, because we haven't done anything to resolve the underlying circumstances. And I don't want to see my grandson and probably his grandson fight. But that's where we're headed. If we don't get a grip on these underlying social, economic, and political issues that radicalize hundreds of thousands of young men and women who desperately just want prospects. That's the first issue. That's what's causing so many of these problems in the Middle East and the broader North African, Middle East, South Asian regions. And it's really the cause for the Arab Spring, the so-called Arab Spring. It wasn't about faith. To some extent, there was that component within it. But it primarily was about large segments of the population, what's often called the youth bulge, of kids who had no hope. They turned on their governments, and one after another, they went down. Tunisia went down. Libya went down. Egypt went down twice. Yemen's gone down. Iraq's nearly gone down. Many of the other states in the Gulf were violently assailed by civil unrest, and of course the great poster child of how bad this can be, a region with failed governments and engaged in civil war, is Syria. Syria is the ultimate example of how bad this can be, and unless we try to get, as I said, to the underlying circumstances, we're going to find more of these examples, and that's going to be a real problem for us. So with that as context, these violent extremist organizations, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, Abu Sayyaf, Jemaah Islamiyah, all of these organizations typically have many of the same characteristics. And in the case of ISIL, it was, in fact, a component of Al-Qaeda, and we fought them. We fought them in Iraq. In fact, we killed the leader of that organization, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who was a mad dog, in my mind, and we didn't get his deputy, and his deputy today is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, also known as Caliph Ibrahim, the leader of the so-called caliphate. And so the organization, Mac, is a symptom of something bigger, something darker, something that has yet to be resolved by the people in the region because of their limited capacity.
Now, I think this is important because I often talk about the irrelevance of the, oh, we whacked the head of, you know, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, right? AQAP, right? So it doesn't seem to matter. It's an irrelevant statistic. It's like the body count in Vietnam. Why? Because of what he just said. This organization is a symptom of a larger underlying, right, situation. So I think that's important.
It is yet to be fully embraced by the community of nations as, in many respects, the kind of existential threat that the Soviets were to the West many years ago. So ISIL is a symptom of something worse. We're engaged now in dealing with it, but in dealing with ISIL, it can't be the end state of our effort. It has to be a waypoint in the larger, probably generationally oriented effort that we have to undertake.
Just another preliminary.
Now, think about that, right? So ISIL is a waypoint on this longer engagement and economic development of the Middle East, right? And aspirationally, it's to take the Middle East down the road that we thought we were taking China down, which is greater engagement, okay? Greater engagement will bring moderation for the extremist elements and will take away the motivation of young people, particularly young men, to become radicalized and then identify with these radical ideologies. Okay, so that's the thought. Now think about that. What have we done to that end, right, since 2016? So in the last 4 years, what have we done? It's almost 4 years to the month when we did this interview. Have we made strides at all? Do you see the forming of something that would transform the Middle East? And the answer to that is no. The good news in the last 6 months relative to the Middle East is Iran is pretty quiet in the region these days, right? Iran has major, major issues at home and it's not currently the player that they were low 6 months ago in the region. Now, that could change, but currently Iran has major problems domestically. So General Allen continues. I mean, to me, I was listening to this, and I was like, wow. Wow. I'm brilliant sometimes.
Binary.
I'm joking.
As.
Kind of.
Before I let that tape roll, that is probably the best 4 minutes and 15 seconds of audio that I have heard relative to an explanation. And I know there's people that say, to hell with it, just walk away from it. But I think if you accept, to hell with it, just walking away from it, you are going to accept Orlando, you're going to accept Paris, you're going to accept Nice, and whatever we will add to that list of cities, you'll accept that as a permanent state of life. So, I don't know how you accept that as a permanent state of life. And it's not an American responsibility. We all have a piece of it. To include, I'll tell you what, you know who's got a piece in this, and because they have a huge Muslim population, is Russia. Russia's got to be a part of it. And so they...
I must have ingested crack that day. Like, Russia, like they're going to be helpful ever?
I think they're enjoying, the Western Hemisphere struggling with this. But I'll tell you what, make no mistake about it. Russia's got a huge problem with this. And so, again, I think as General Allen talks about, it needs to be a plan past the kinetics, our coalition partners, to address the economics, the governance issues of a generation that's not heard. And why aren't they heard? Muammar Gaddafi, he wasn't listening. Bashar al-Assad in Syria, he's not listening. Saddam Hussein, he wasn't listening. They don't get listened to. And so we know what happens in any civilization. When there's issues and people don't listen, then you got a problem. We got a problem. He continues. But I'll tell you what, that little 4 minute clip, 4 minutes and 15 seconds, awesome.
Iran and Saudi Arabia do this dance, and until they can, as nations, as peoples, until they can accept the joint responsibility to work together, to accept each other's presence, nothing productive happens. And we can fake it. We can fence them off. You know, we can go there, and we can keep the lid on it. But until Saudi Arabia and Iran somehow or other accept each other's presence, I don't. How does this work, sir?
Well, it hasn't obviously for a very long time, and you know it's a really perceptive question on your part.
How about that? Really perceptive question on your part. Now, what he didn't put in there was, and a bit surprising, Mac, by the way. But it's like he's thinking out loud and like, what the hell did he just say? Very perceptive question on your part. Yeah, hello, Mr. Perceptive. That would be me, he continues.
I talked to people who are trying to understand the region. One of the first things I tell them is, in your analysis, as you seek to understand the region, as you seek to react to events that are unfolding before you, if one of the first considerations that you have isn't what I call the Cold War between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the revolutionary Islamic regime in Tehran, if that isn't one of your earliest considerations as to why something is happening in the region, you're probably going to miss the reality in your analysis. That's the first thing. Now, why is there competition? It's only partly religion, and maybe isn't mostly religion, or the confession that one worships Shia for the Iranians and Sunnah for the Saudis. I would contend that it's really much bigger than that. It is competition politically. It's hegemonic competition to dominate as much of the influence in the region as possible. It's economic competition in the context of the oil enterprise. And then in there somewhere is the inherent friction that comes from a violent Shia revolutionary regime bumping up against a fundamentalist Sunni Wahhabi-oriented system of faith in the kingdom. And all of that makes for what would appear to be frozen conflict. So, you know, the recent comments came out of Washington of something to the effect of, why don't you guys just figure out how to arrange the neighborhood and share the neighborhood? That couldn't have gone down more difficultly in the region, because those guys aren't interested in sharing anything, and they're not gonna. And the Iranian effort to have a nuclear weapon has spurred the Saudis, and King Abdullah, before he passed away, Saudi Arabia said to me twice that Saudi Arabia will never end up number two in a nuclear arms race. These are big stakes here in the region. And unless the United States is part of the process to keep the lid on it, this could go badly. And the complete collapse of Yemen is probably one of the examples of what happens when we aren't involved in the process and the Saudis undertake a military coalition to defeat the Houthis, who they believe and probably are supported by the Iranians. And it's very much a Cold War environment at several different levels, and it makes stability in the region, in the Gulf, but more broadly in the region, it makes finding stability and ensuring stability pretty difficult.
With that as a backdrop, what is the way ahead for the United States and the coalition that you essentially crafted? What is the way ahead for the United States and its coalition in the fight against ISIL?
Well, we're gaining traction now. As I said to...
Now, let me just remind you of when this was. I mean, General Allen was tasked by President Obama with putting together a coalition and to fight ISIL. So ISIL swept through western Iraq, right, then wrapped around the city of Baghdad. They had entered Mosul, and they controlled much of Syria, right? And so this is probably ISIL at its apex when this interview is going on. And we're talking about how does this work. Now, in the intervening years, we know how that turned out, and it wasn't very good for the ISIL team. They no longer, you know, exist in terms of their caliphate, which they had aspired to. That has been destroyed, and they have morphed into other things. And I dare say that should the right circumstances occur, and in particular, if something isn't done economically in the region, you know, but I would say by the free nations of the world to create economic hope in the region, then you will see ISIL reappear again. So that again, so keep that in mind in terms of what was going on at the time.
Leaders in Washington, you can't take on an organization that looks like a juggernaut. You can't take it on frontally as we did in a moment of really grave emergency in the late summer of 14 and expect to have immediate results. And so what we did was we chose to take this organization on in roughly five different ways. The first was the military way, which is the most obvious. Gets a lot of the attention, but it isn't in the end where the decision will be determined. So we have the military activity going on, and there's a lot of purchase occurring. We've taken back a lot of the ground, liberated a lot of the population. Cities that you knew and I knew have either been liberated or are being liberated. We're fighting in Fallujah even as you and I speak right now.
Roger.
Another area is the area of the finances. The finances provide the capacity for the organization to operate. And we've really begun to shrink the finances by attacking the oil enterprise, shrinking the capacity of the banking system to provide the platform for economic solvency. We've gone after their leaders. We're attacking their cash repositories. They had quite a large amount of cash that they took out of the banks. Gone after those. We're shrinking their financial assets. We've begun the process in a comprehensive way of reducing the flow of foreign fighters. They have been reduced substantially from the beginning. We're attacking their narrative, going after them in an information conflict, and then we're stabilizing the population. But all of that doesn't happen overnight. It took us a year to get organized, a year to assemble the resources, and in the second year of the campaign, the tide has turned against the enemy. But as I've told everyone all along, we can't find ourselves at the end of the 3 or 4 years it's going to take us to defeat Daesh. Lift our heads up and say, oh, good, now we're finished. Because we're not finished, because they're just as Daesh is a lineal descendant of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and Al-Qaeda is a lineal descendant of other extremist organizations, if we don't get after, as I said previously, if we don't get after the underlying reasons why the people of that region are radicalized and forced into the arms of these violent extremists, if we don't get after that, we are going to fight son of Daesh and grandson of Daesh, and it's going to go for a long time.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
That is the single best discussion that I've heard about ISIL and about Afghanistan in a relatively short period of time. That's John Allen.
Now, ISIL in Iraq, right, and then Afghanistan. So we in that 30 minutes of audio, we talked about both areas of operation and what it would take in either one. And you look and, you know, very typically, right, we're at the same place 4 years later where the president is seeking to draw down, right, to improve his chances at the ballot box so he can stand up and say, I've ended the war here. On what terms, to what end, I guess, American people that worry about American strategy in America in the long term would ask, right? Would ask, have you ceded, you know, too much influence in the Middle East to the Russians, right? In our haste to leave, what have we done? What will become of Afghanistan? Is that our concern? Do we care? Do we have interests in the region that would tether us to Afghanistan? And so to me, those are the hard questions as America views its grand, you know, and General Allen is huge on talking America's grand strategy and the fact that we don't seem to be able to link what we do operationally, militarily, which we tend to be able to achieve with some larger strategic goal that tends to be elusive to us. We don't seem to be able to convert military action to strategic gain. And so General Allen is a huge, you know, is a huge, you know, believer in America's got to do better, you know, in its grand strategic vision. And then everything else lines up in support of that vision, right? And I think it gives you a longer view of the world. And not just this four-year view that, you know, is completely a function of, you know, the president attempting to be reelected. I think it also points out the danger when you don't go to war, you know, with the War Powers Act and you don't go to war with Congress, in concert with Congress. And that becomes an annual tug-of-war or tug-of-war, you know, every so often. And we don't have, I mean, think about it. I mean, do you think if we'd have fought World War II, you know, recently, would we have stayed in Germany and Japan for as long as we needed to make sure that, you know, we won the peace? Or would there have been too many voices that said, hey, we just need to unask those shitholes and come home? Well, I mean, that's what we did in World War I. And World War I begat an even larger event known as World War II. And the world order that has existed post-World War II, largely built by the United States and the United Kingdom, is a rules-based order based on freedom and has led to a pretty long period where we haven't had major conflict on the planet. And so what's interesting now is, you know, China has every intention of, you know, of usurping that world order. And that's China's threat to the planet. And you have, you know, what, four great actors on the stage, all, you know, in totalitarian, all totalitarian regimes, but China being number one. And again, so no small deal yesterday when the Secretary of State of the United States addresses the Chinese people and, you know, and says they need to redirect the Chinese Communist Party. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean overthrow, you know, President Xi? And Secretary Pompeo would probably say, and I haven't seen any comments to it, but Secretary Pompeo would probably say, oh, of course that doesn't mean that. You know, but in my opinion, it, for people that are advocating it, they would point to his remarks and say, the Americans are down with it. They think it's a good idea. And so so you have, you know, China, you have Russia, which never seems to do anything good other than, you know, what's in Mr. Putin's best interest. And the Russians are so averse to, you know, the reformation of their country based on their horrible experience coming out of years and years of just their, and this is my analysis, but I mean, Russia is a backwards country that's so full of corruption that it can, You know, it can barely see its way forward. And their experiment with democracy, you know, the jolt to the body was so severe that they say, yeah, we're not going back there anytime soon. So anyway, and so Mr. Putin, to many of them, is a throwback to the glorious days of the Soviet Union and Russia is a major part of that. So so between the devil and the deep blue, you know, Mr. Putin continues to be employed. Iran and North Korea would form the other two great, I think, totalitarian dangers to the planet, right? And against that stands the free nations of the world. And what, again, just recently, in the last couple of weeks, what is probably the most encouraging thing that has happened relative to that is the decision by the United Kingdom to tell everybody that's a part of the 5G infrastructure that Huawei will not be a part of it, and that any Huawei components that are currently a part of the 5G infrastructure in the United Kingdom need to be out of that system within 36 months. So that I don't know that you can overstate that that decision by the United Kingdom, and here's why. The rules-based order of the second half of the 20th century and the first part of the 21st century is important. And the free nations of the world have to stop playing the emperor's new clothes with the Chinese. And China has to be bent to conform to the world-based order, which means there has to be consequences for their action in the South China Sea. And so the reason why the actions of the UK are so important is that it's the UK acting, right, in congruence with, aligned with, if you will, the United States. That is the most dangerous course of action for China. China's, the way that it likes to deal with everybody is we like to deal with everybody one-on-one. And then what happens is we allow you to sell into China. We get you addicted to it, much like becoming a drug addict. And then when you're addicted to our demand, when you've expanded sectors of your economy, then what we do is we threaten to cut you off. Now you know what will happen to your economy. You know what your will happen to your chances for re-election if that happens. And so you've danced with the devil. And now the devil requires to be paid for it, the dance. And if you say no, your political career is over. But doing the right thing for your country probably entails saying no. So really the significance of what the UK did was they acted in concert with, you know, the leader of the free world, and that is the United States. And so the other thing that you're seeing here that's been in the work for months and will hopefully be expanded is just recently, this past week, you've seen the United States Navy, the Australian Navy, and the Japanese Navy conducting operations in the Philippine Sea. Hopefully, in the not-too-distant future, that will include, you know, maybe those all those same elements operating in the Indian Ocean with the Indian Navy. And then maybe someday you'll see Vietnamese, you know, maritime, you know, the Vietnamese Navy, whatever it is, and it doesn't really matter what it is. And then, you know, one could hope that someday you would see the Philippine Navy involved in it again, because they used to be. And what that is the outward symbol of these nations beginning to align themselves together, and that ultimately they will look at China and say, okay, if you're going to deal with us, we expect you to do these things, and if you don't, then we will all take action against you. And China can't stand up to that. And that's the only way China will be brought to heel and will be brought to into the rules-based order of the world. And but that's going to take some doing, because China doesn't see the world like that. They see the world bending to its economy. So anyway, I wanted to share that with you, because I thought that, I don't know, it's like about 25 minutes of audio, was absolutely incredible. was absolutely incredible. And so I ran across it yesterday. I listened to it for a while. I thought, you know what? I'm not sure what I'm going to do tomorrow, but I will go ahead and share that with everybody. Here's a text message from one of my very, very smart friends. He parrots Mattis on this, on the U.S. doesn't have a strategy. Well, then write the strategy and give it to the Congress and the president. This soundbite is easy to say, much more difficult to do. Why do we even write a national defense strategy and a national military strategy? Senior military then say we have no strategy. No plan survives first contact. Same goes with strategy. Strategy is hard to do, and Americans don't seem to be too good at it. I mean, we write the documents, but how does it manifest itself in the actions of the State Department, right, in the actions of the nation? Okay. And again, so what General Allen's talking about is some kind of Marshall-esque type plan for the Middle East if you're really serious about eradicating Islamic fundamentalism. What you have to do is you have to create hope in those civilizations. So why would I go out and pick up a rifle if I can go get a good job and if I can go live the life I want to live and I can go live the dreams I want to live? I would tell you the same thing has to do with, you know, inner city violence. I mean, look at Chicago, for God's sake. How do you restore economic hope to, you know, the young men of the city of Chicago so they don't get involved in gangs and the drug trade? How do you do that? It's essentially the same question, except it's a domestic event, not an international event. So interesting stuff. And strategy's hard. Strategy's hard. And it's, and the United States has not been in that business for very long. Post-World War II, probably, you could argue, when we really got serious about global strategy and a national defense strategy. But it's one thing to write the document. It's another thing for it to lay down like that, which means successive administrations and the funding from Congress. So anyway, I mean, to me, I find it very interesting. I find it very interesting. And what's most sobering, though, is is when we commit American armed forces and we don't win the peace, that's, in my opinion, that's morally indefensible, right? You go to war to win the peace. You go to war to shape the world to your vision. And you should not ask ever the American people for a sacrifice that involves sons and daughters, mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers, and then not achieve your strategic ends. That should be illegal, right? And if you do that as a president of the United States and you fail, you should go to jail. Whoa, Mac. So what I'm saying is George Bush, he should go to jail. Can't do that. You can't fuck it up that bad. And then you can't write books and make millions of dollars on that. So Dick Cheney, you know, Condoleezza Rice, they should all put it. You could put them all in the same block. Same cell block. I don't really give a shit. But 7,052, and that number went up one this week. Americans have been killed in fighting our wars. And will Iraq be anything that contributes to international peace and stability when it's all done? Good question, right? It won't if Iran holds sway there. Will Afghanistan be anything that contributes to peace and stability in the international community? It won't if the Taliban run the show there. And so what the hell did we do? What the hell did we do? My friend who's a genius, our strategy is the pesticide strategy. Just keep spraying. Lay down ant bait and hopefully they will take it back to the nest and kill the rest. Well, let me tell you, I don't think the insect strategy is working well. But what do I know? Anyway, on a Friday, look for the Lynch Kenny thing tomorrow if you missed that. And if you missed it, since most people did, we had an interesting conversation about the Bonhomme Richard. Hard to believe that American warship in port could burn for 4 days, 4.5 days. So we talked about that. And we talked about Egypt, Ethiopia, and Sudan. Will Cosentini is a foreign area officer, a FAO, which means ugly in Spanish, right? But it's really the initials. It's not a word, okay? So it's not applicable. But Will, his area of expertise was the Middle East and lived in Egypt for a year. And so he kind of explains a little bit about the damming of the Nile River, which Ethiopia is doing, and which is going to have a pretty big impact on Egypt. So the things wars are made out of, water. So we talk about that, and I can't remember what else, but look for that. It'll go up tomorrow. So on a Friday, have a great day. I have a conversation with the VA coming up here in about 54 minutes. The VA wants to talk to me about post-traumatic winning, so I'm excited about that. But I don't know that ultimately, I think that post-traumatic winning is more suited for the private sector. And they get it. A lot of those guys that I meet are veterans. And they're now very successful. They fought in Iraq and Afghanistan. And they're more than willing to fund it because they get it. They've lived it. They're Marines who they deeply care about have lived it. And again, they've gone to gatherings and they see that they've lost more to suicide than they did in combat. And that literally is just a knife in the heart. And they want to change it. Bureaucracies, be it the DOD or the VA, you know, with the number of PhDs, honestly, if post-traumatic winning is right, then the programs they've created might be wrong. That's not really the people you want to be selling to. But we'll see. I keep my fingers crossed because I've seen, and I just did it in Montana last week, guys who fought in Fallujah, guys who fought in Afghanistan. And, you know, I'm in touch with a bunch of them, even this morning, earlier today. One of them is a police officer in the Midwest. He's on the SWAT team. You know, sent me an email, "Hey, Mac, I'd love for you to come and do your thing here." And I said, "Okay, let me tell you how you do it, man. You split the cost between whatever municipalities want to, you know, are interested in doing it, and the unions. Okay, so that's the way to make it cheap and affordable for everybody. And then invite other people in. Invite adjacent counties to send their people. I'll do it a bunch of times. It doesn't matter to me. And that drives the cost down for everybody. But know this. You are going to save people's lives. And just like you've gone home and said, man, I want to bring that to my community. You know, the people that attend will go back into their churches, will go back to into their mental health support groups. And they'll look at people and say, hey, there's a better path. And these chucklehead Marines somehow or other have stumbled into it. But it's all based in the truth and it's no bullshit. And we can go there. So, yeah, so exciting stuff. So anyway, have a great weekend. All Marine Radio on a Friday is over and finished. Finito. So have a great weekend. See you Monday.